Let's get started. So today we're going to have one more lecture talking about dimensional reduction, which is a form of unsupervised learning. So last week we talked about principal component analysis, and today we're going to just wrap up a few more points about that, and then I'll show you another method for dimensional reduction that's not just a linear transformation. Specifically, we're going to talk about this T-distributed stochastic neighbor embedding. But first, I just want to show you a few examples of what you get when you apply dimensional reduction to some different data sets. And also, your homework too is going to be about doing dimensional reduction using a few different techniques. So you'll have everything that you need to do that homework after today, but I'm going to just wait till tomorrow to post it just so you don't have two homeworks to worry about at the same time. So that'll be coming tomorrow. So let's first just look at some visualization. So this first one I'm starting with showing you, this is a two-dimensional visualization. And this is actually using this TSNE method that I haven't shown you yet, but let me just start by showing you what you get when you use it. So this one specifically was used on this database of these handwritten digits. So you get somebody to write down a number from 0 to 9, and then you feed it into this dimensional reduction algorithm, visualize it in a lower space. And if you look really closely, you'll see each data point is actually a little image of the digit. So all of these ones here are zeros, for example. These ones are all twos, etc. And then in the corner, they've done the same picture, but they've colored it by what the digit is supposed to be. So this is something that is often nice to kind of visualize maybe separately, just because we don't want to think that the color is part of the input to the algorithm. In lots of cases, you might look at data where you don't know the label. That's a big motivation for using supervised learning, is because we don't know labels. So here, the label was kind of used to check how well we were doing. So you see it's doing a pretty good job. Lots of these clusters have mostly one color. There's a few places where it's not getting it quite right, but you can see this dimensional reduction is doing a pretty good job of clustering this data. And what is this? This one is using PCA here. So this is another paper where they used PCA in one case and TSNE in the other case, and again, visualizing this handwritten digit. So you can see using PCA, they were able to get some of the clusters in the same area, but not really forming these distinct clusters. But then using this TSNE algorithm, they get these nice distinct clusters. And now this is just the same, again, this same MNIST handwritten digits data set. But in this case, I'll just show you what happens when you run this in 3D. So again, most of what we're going to do in this class, we're going to look at these 2D visualizations because it's just nice and easy to look at. But you can also run this in 3 dimensions or, of course, higher if you want. But these are just some different results that you get. And now let me show you specifically what we're going to look at in the homework, which is, of course, the Ising model. So in homework one, what you were basically doing is you were training a neural network on this Ising model data set to learn these labels. So maybe paramagnetic is label 0, ferromagnetic is label 1. So we were trying to use supervised learning to do this task. So again, to emphasize, in this homework one that's due today, you were making explicit use of these labels in the algorithm that you were using. And now in homework two, what you're going to do, you're still going to look at spin configurations from the Ising model, but now you're not going to have any knowledge of the labels. And you're going to use some dimensional reduction algorithms to try to gain some insight into what's going on. And I just kind of like to show a set of pictures like this and imagine that you as a human were trying to do this task. So imagine I give you this set of pictures and I don't give you any labels to tell you what's going on, but I just try to ask you, you know, can you maybe group this data in some way to tell me what are the kinds of things that I should be looking for? And what you would hope you might be able to do is say, okay, these three pictures all look kind of random. They all have approximately an equal number of black and white areas of the image. So I'm going to call that group one. You wouldn't know that that's called paramagnetic, but maybe you'd be able to do that. And you might be able to say that these ones I'm going to call group two because they have some kind of a preference for what color that they are on average. But actually more likely what you would do, I would think, you would probably be able to say this is group one, this is group two, and this is group three. So we might not actually distinguish into paramagnetic and ferromagnetic, but it's maybe more natural to divide into three groups, paramagnetic and ferromagnetic, where most spins are up, and ferromagnetic, where most are down. So we're going to see that's actually kind of what more naturally happens in the cases we look at. And so let me just show you some papers that you're going to be reproducing and studying in this homework. So the first one here, this is using just principal component analysis to study the icing model for different sizes. So the three different plots are just for different sizes. So it becomes easier to notice these kind of distinct clusters representing different phases on bigger sizes. So you can see when you go up to L equals 80, you should find on your homework that you get somewhat distinct clusters. And again, they've used the temperature to color this after the fact. So that temperature is not used at all in the algorithm, but it's just used as kind of a check of how well it does in the end. So we get this big paramagnetic cluster in the middle, and then we get these two ferromagnetic clusters for the different magnetization values. So again, whether we are preferring mostly up or mostly down, we kind of get these two different clusters. And you're gonna study this more and try to understand exactly what it's learning in the homework assignment. And just kind of like take a mental picture of this last image, because on the next slide, I'm gonna show you what you get using this different algorithm, this TSNE instead. You can see here, this is the same data. This is a different paper, and they used this other algorithm. And in this case, you tend to get more distinct clusters forming. Again, the temperature was used to see how well we're doing. And we again get these three clusters forming. And this is another thing that you're gonna study and reproduce for homework too. So do you guys have any questions about those kind of goals of the homework and just visualizations, what the visualizations look like of what we're kind of working towards explaining? Oh yeah, question, yeah.
This is nitpicking, but if I was colorblind and you showed me that initial color plot,
yeah,
I would be able to distinguish it. So right. Can I say that coloring is just sort of adding a third dimension where we just visualize the data?
Yeah, so color, yeah, no, that's a really good point. So again, just let me emphasize, the color is not at all used in the algorithm. It's just used as a visual way to check, but absolutely you could do that in a different way. So if I go back to the first slide, I mean, I know this is really tiny, but if you zoom in here, here they actually were doing this by showing the image of what you started with. You could also, if you knew the label and you were trying to check on some data set where you knew the label, you could put the actual label here, for example, or you could, yeah, you could try to do, you know, some quantitative analysis of how many labels did I get right. There's some algorithms that exist for actually identifying clusters, and then you could try to check how many of the labels were right in that cluster. So definitely it's not actually needed in the algorithm. It's just a visual way of checking, and absolutely you could find more accessible ways to do that checking. That's a good point. Anything else? Okay, great. Okay, so I've kind of written down here something that we already talked about last time, which is just the notation of what we're trying to do in dimensional reduction, which is that we start with some data set that has m samples. Each of them has n components, and often we're going to look at data sets where this n is large so that it's difficult to visualize our data set. And by doing dimensional reduction, we can try to get a data set that represents the same thing as my original data set, but with a smaller number of components. And specifically, we're going to look at cases where we do this in, well, for us too, you could also do it in three dimensions, And then we can visualize what's going on. So I just have a couple things to say about PCA to continue from last time. And then we'll spend most of the lecture talking about TSNE, T-S-N-E. So we said last time PCA amounts to solving an eigenvalue problem. What we introduced was this notation. So this matrix V, this is based on my original data set. The reason I have this C notation on the X is that I've centered the data set. We talked about this last time. And then put it here. So just to remind you of the notation we introduced, this P matrix is going to store the principal components. It's going to explain how I get my transformed data set. D is some diagonal matrix that I'm going to sort. And specifically, I can express it like this. We saw this last time. All of these eigenvalues we can show are greater than zero, greater than or equal to zero. And one more thing we talked about. Is that, you know, PCA is not always a useful method, this linear transformation isn't always going to give us useful insight, but if it does, then we should see that these eigenvalues decrease pretty quickly. So if it was almost flat, then we wouldn't really gain anything by using PCA, but we might be able to have a more efficient representation of our data if our eigenvalues decay quickly like this. And to maybe quantify this a little bit more, on your homework, you're going to specifically look at something called the explained variance ratio. So this is defined by basically normalizing these eigenvalues. So this is basically, you know, as you might have been able to guess from the title, this R is basically measuring how much of the variance in my data set can I explain with the principal component. Sorry, I shouldn't have said first. Whatever principal component I'm talking about. How much of my variance of my data set am I explaining there? And I just wanted to kind of make a connection to some other terminology you'll often talk about in numerics. You might hear discussion of signal versus noise in your data. And for PCA, if we have directions that have a high explained variance ratio, we would say those directions correspond to some kind of signal, and other directions might correspond to noise. So let me just try to draw. I'll do my best to draw an example of this. So. Perhaps I have a data set where I identify some x1 prime as the important direction, so that in this two-dimensional space, one dimension has most of the variance in the data. So maybe I have something like this. I think I should make it more pronounced. It's not always easy to try to draw these like big data sets on the board. I'm trying to illustrate it, but. So in this case, the largest variance we might identify as being on this x1 prime direction, whereas there's more noise along the x2 prime direction. So our x1 prime direction would be the first principal component in this case. So that's all I really want to say about PCA for now, although just to say again, you're going to look at it more on the homework. You guys have any questions about PCA before we move on to something else? Yeah.
So we identify the smaller and the larger eigenvalues. Based on that, we identify explained variance ratio. But then how do we like visualize in terms of n is equal to 2 or 3? It's like I don't see where the dimensional reduction.
Yeah. So what you would do basically is that you would not. So if I look at this plot, for example, and they're decaying very quickly, I would then just only plot, if I said maybe from here, I would determine, okay, I'm explaining, I don't know, like 90% of my explained variance is in those first two components. So then I would just plot x1 prime versus x2 prime. And it would, you know, it would contain a lot of the variance in my data. So then I would just plot two axes or three axes of the data, the x1 prime, x2 prime, x3 prime. Whereas if you do that in the original space, you could, of course, just choose a couple of components, but it's probably not containing everything that you need. Any other questions? Yeah.
Do the eigenvalues need to decay like exponentially, or is that too strong a condition to impose?
To say that this is a useful thing to do. I don't know that. Yeah, in terms of like exactly what cutoff, I don't know that it's really about how fast they decay, but maybe kind of the, if you were looking at only two components, maybe more important to think about like, what is this R value for those two components? Like what percentage of my data? And of course, you're always gonna have to say that as a caveat on what you're visualizing. You'll say, you know, the explained variance ratio of these two components is, you know, 95% or something like that. And so that's gonna give you an idea of like, how much of the data set am I representing visualization? Anything else? Okay, so let's talk about another algorithm now that's not just a linear transformation. Although I want to emphasize that just because this algorithm is maybe more general in terms of the kind of transformation it does, it's not just linear. It doesn't mean that we would always use it instead of PCA, because one advantage of PCA that you're going to kind of see in the homework and appreciate, I hope, is that you're really able to understand the transformation that it's doing. I'm going to solve exactly for this transformation of how I should get my new data set X prime from my original data set X. And then I can kind of look at that transformation that it's doing and try to understand some of the physics underlying. Whereas here, we're going to see we kind of lose some of the interpretability of what's going on in that reduction. So definitely, you still want to have PCA in your toolkit, because there's situations where it's something nice to try that can help you learn a bit about your data set. So a lot of our discussion here is going to be based on a probability distribution known as the similarity. So this similarity, it's defined using this exponential in terms of the distance between points. And a way that you can kind of think of it that is described in the paper where Tisney is introduced, I should emphasize the reference where they derive this algorithm. You're going to be looking into that in the homework. So you're going to be reading through some of the paper where they talk about this. So just to kind of tell you the language that they use in this paper is that they introduce this similarity and they kind of think of it as the probability that some data point X would choose this data point XJ as a neighbor among all the points that it could choose. And again, we want to kind of define neighborhood based on distance. And so And also, let me see. These sigma I are free parameters, and we have this notion now of a neighborhood of a point. You guys have any questions so far?
I'm just confused why, I mean, it's probably just the definition, but probability of I given I is zero.
Yeah, it's, again, it wouldn't be if you used this formula. It's because the way, I think it'll make more sense when we see what the algorithm is actually trying to do. It's trying to kind of like start with a point and choose, you know, what points around that are similar. So it just doesn't really want to consider itself. So it's really just, I don't think it's not, maybe it doesn't even make sense to think of it. Maybe it makes more sense to say the probability it would choose itself as a neighbor should be very high, but it's basically that we wanna, if you think of those visualizations, we wanna start with a point and try to think what should be close to that point in this visualization. So we don't wanna consider putting the same point anywhere. So it's just because in the algorithm, we wanna consider each point once that this just means you're gonna consider all of the other m minus one points when you're looking at one point. So actually, in the paper, they describe that they did some experiments using this distribution and then also using a symmetrized version of this distribution. And I know I haven't told you the algorithm yet, but I'm just kind of starting with some definitions. But let me tell you that they found that on certain data sets, it worked better to use a symmetrized version of this distribution. So that's the one that's going to be discussed here, but again, it's defined very similarly to this one. And so now I can kind of restate the goal of dimensional reduction in the case of TSNE using these definitions. So really the goal of TSNE is to find this new data set where I'm going to now call my points X prime. And this new representation should preserve this similarity distribution. And for this lower dimensional representation, they actually use a different distribution, and I'm going to explain why they were motivated to use something different. So rather than using a Gaussian to represent the similarity in this lower dimensional space, they use something that they call this T-student distribution. And now you can see the reason for part of the name of this algorithm. So it's defined similarly, but rather than using a Gaussian, we use this 1 over 1 plus z squared. You know, when we're talking about, and then we put in the distance as the argument there again. So it's still based on distances, but in a different way. And I'm going to kind of motivate why they did that. Let me just say, before doing that, before kind of talking about why they chose this form, let me just say that in this algorithm, we're really going to see that we prioritize preserving the short distance, the short distances, or yeah, the cases where the similarity in the case where this distance is small. That's going to be the priority in the algorithm. So, of course, the goal would be to preserve the entire similarity as much as possible. But we'll see that in cases where we kind of have to choose, we're going to choose to preserve that points that were close originally are still close. And if they maybe can't, points that were far, maybe the distance of how far they were might not be preserved in the new space. You guys have questions so far?
What is the QIJ denoting? Is what
I yeah, okay, yeah, let me say this more clearly. So this is what we're going to call the similarity, but in the low dimensional space. Thank you. That makes it more clear. I always struggle with how to summarize on the board, so it's good that you tell me when I summarize and removed information that was crucial. Okay, any other questions? Okay.
Once we have, what will be the use of this similarity? Because using P, we have already reduced the dimension.
Well, because we can't use that as a measure because we want to make sure we're still generating this lower dimensional representation, X prime. So we have to have a way of measuring how does this new representation compare to what I started with. So to motivate why they use this distribution, there's several reasons. Let me see.
By T student, you mean?
I mean this distribution. Why did they choose this form here? You know, it might be more obvious to just also use a Gaussian, and I'm going to show you why they didn't do that. So and again, the reference for this is on the portal, and it's also going to be in your homework. Specifically, they talk about something called the crowding problem. So I'm just going to kind of tell you one thing that's the result of this crowding problem, sorry, you can read more about it too. Let's look at a specific example. where we're going from two dimensions and trying to go to one dimension. So let me say that this is where I start. I'm going to just consider three data points, and x0 is 1 unit away from x1. x1 and x2 are also 1 unit away together, and they kind of form this right angle triangle, so that x0 and x2 are root 2 away. So let's say I gave you this problem, and I said do dimensional reduction as best as you can, and in cases where you have to make a choice, preserve the short distances. Well, I could start by putting my point x0 prime somewhere. And okay, the smallest distance I have here is 1. So let's see, I'll say, okay, then my x1 prime should be unit 1 away from here. And now the other short distance I have, which is just as small, is this one here. So then I would have to choose to put my x2 prime over here. But now this means that my points 0 and 2 are distance 2 apart rather than root 2. And because of this crowding problem that happens when you go from higher dimensions to lower dimensions, we're often going to run into issues like this, where if we're prioritizing keeping the very small distances, then the distances that are on the larger scales are going to have to get pushed out even bigger. And so now let's see what we can learn from this example in terms of how to choose a similarity. So remember, similarity is a function of distance. Can you guys read this here? Probably not, hey? Let me put the board up a little bit. Is it okay now? Can you read it now? Yeah. Great. So let's draw first. A bit lower. Let's draw first what a Gaussian would look like here. And this is what I used to measure my similarity in my original space. So if I use this distribution and I'm thinking, I'm just going to clarify something here too. So specifically here, I'm just kind of zooming in and focusing on these points 0 and 2 in this example. So you can see that if I use the same distribution when I'm in my lower dimensional representation, if I also use a Gaussian, what happens is that the similarity in that case is going to be suppressed from what it was originally. And so what they end up doing is using something with a longer tail. So So again, this is just the motivation for why they chose something that has a longer tail. So that in these cases where these distances have to get pushed out further, we can still have a better chance of preserving this similarity, since that's what we really care about in the algorithm. And I should have labeled my axis. This is the similarity on the y-axis. So again, just to repeat myself, because this is important, is that since this t-student distribution has this longer tail, in that case, it means we can preserve the similarity out to larger distances. And specifically here, for this little example, it means that this P02 is close to the Q02. So similarity in original space and new space are similar. Any questions about that? Okay, so I've kind of told you what the goal is here, that we want to preserve this similarity, but how do we actually define an algorithm that does that? So we actually end up using a learning algorithm similarly to the ones we saw in supervised learning. But in this case, our cost is going to be defined in terms of these probability distributions. So this is the cost function that we tend to use in this case, and it's actually called the Kullback-Leibler divergence. How many of you have heard of this before? Okay. Here, I'm just curious. So let me tell you a few things about this KL divergence, because it's used here, but it's also used many other places in machine learning, specifically in generative modeling. You'll see it come up a lot. So you can use Jensen's inequality, and you can show that this quantity, it's always greater than or equal to zero. If you succeed at doing this dimensional reduction perfectly so that you preserve the similarity for all points, then it'll be zero. And as I kind of alluded to, you will also see this come up a lot in other unsupervised learning tasks. So just remember, in unsupervised learning in general, we're trying to look at some aspect of a probability distribution of our data. And so then in this case, we're looking at kind of how does our original probability distribution compare with the new one that we're generating. Any questions? Okay, so I just want to say a few more things about TSNE. Couple other things that, you know, just because it's a lot of new notation for one day, I just want to make sure that these points are clear. So this P distribution, there's two probability distributions, P and Q. P is fixed by the data set that you're given. So just to emphasize what you're really adjusting in this algorithm, you're adjusting these points x prime. And by doing that, you're adjusting this similarity in the lower space, q. And we want to have that similarity close to p. Now I want to talk about how we can see that we're prioritizing this local small distance structure. Thank you. So the way we can see that we're prioritizing this local structure over just matching the entire similarity for all distances is that in this expression, there's this p here that's kind of acting as a weight. And you can show that this p is going to be larger when my original coordinates are close to each other. And one more thing. One thing that, again, I hope you'll appreciate more by doing homework too, is that this lower representation that I get by doing this TSNE, it's harder to interpret than the lower dimensional representation that I had when I did PCA. So with PCA, I solved this equation, and then I was able to tell you how I could get my x prime coordinates in terms of my x coordinates. But here, I get some new coordinates, and I kind of know what point they correspond to. But knowing what does it mean, why did it choose this path to get there, I don't really have as much of a way of interpreting the underlying physics in quite as easy of a way as I did with PCA. So that's a major trade-off that we have to consider here.